I got up at 4 this morning, slightly off schedule in this time zone, to the hooting of an owl and an idea. I thought that I wasn't able to complete the task in time, but I thought that I would offer a variant tribute to Mary. She had me here in 2008 for another digital event. I talked about the digital humanities then and academic change, and I took away with me a rather nice picture of Mary that I like, that I took standing in front of the English faculty building in a somewhat dramatic and I thought heroic pose. So I spent about a fruitless half hour this morning browsing around the web, looking at pictures by Fuseli and Copley and David and others, trying to find an appropriately heroic history painting to pair with that. And I could not find anything that would not give offense, so or eventually complete that task. Thank you, Mary. You'll see that the title on the screen is not there yet. You see, the title of the screen is not the one in your program. I had intended to give a paper called The State of Digital Humanities, a Report and a Critique. That is actually a 35 to 40 manuscript page article that is coming out in Arts and Humanities in Higher Education, edited by Jan Parker, whom I think is in this area. The scaling back process for that to the size of this talk was not going well, and it was taking me away from the issues of this conference. So instead, what I did was to extract the sliver at the end of the talk that is devoted to critique and expand that, write that up as a new talk, and that's what I'm giving you today. You'll see that there are quite a few strands connecting this paper to issues that have been instrumental, let's put it that way, in this conference here today. One other disclaimer before I begin, I'm going to speak about the digital humanities. Mostly today, I speak about the digital humanities as if they had a capital D and an H, meaning it's the disciplinary formation of that as it is forming up now in such organizations as the Alliance for Digital Humanities Organizations, the ALLC and the AHO, or again in the TEI organization, or again in the Digital Humanities Quarterly that I'm speaking about. I'm a member of those community. I have great affection for them. I'm positioning myself here in the position of an internal critic. I am not speaking about digital humanities in a more Catholic, big tent sense with a small d and a small h. In that larger tent would be organizations like Haystack, which do not exactly fit the disciplinary mode here, primarily because it's vastly occupied by Haystack scholars who are graduate students still in the professionalizing stage. So my title is, Where is Cultural Criticism in the Digital Humanities? As a cue for a thesis I wish to offer about the future of the digital humanities, I start by confessing to a lie that I inserted in the last paragraph of the mission statement of this site, which is called For Humanities. It's something that I co-founded and now coordinate together with Jeffrey Rockwell in Canada and Melissa Terrace in the UK, along with a fairly large collective of participants from the international digital humanities community. Kathy Davidson is in that collective. It began very recently, November 2010, in order to advocate for the humanities at a time when economic retrenchment has accelerated a long-term decline in the perceived value of the humanities. For Humanities serves as a platform for advocacy statements and campaigns. International news and the state of the humanities, showcase examples of humanities work, student voices for the humanities, other ways of speaking up for the humanities, the kind of campaigning the panel was talking about yesterday. But unlike other humanities advocacy campaigns, for example, those of the National Humanities Alliance in the US, or just a couple of examples here responding to the cuts in the UK, the Defend the Arts and Humanities Initiative and the Humanities and Social Sciences Matter initiatives, for humanities has a specific and special premise. As emphasized in the motto on its website, For Humanities is quote-unquote powered by the digital humanities community. The idea is that in today's world of networked communications, the digital humanities have a special role to play in helping the humanities reach out. The last paragraph of the Four Humanities mission statement, which I have to say that I wrote because I'm about to criticize it, thus asserts, Four Humanities began because the digital humanities community, which specializes in making creative use of digital technology to advance humanities research and teaching, as well as to think about the basic nature of the new media and technologies, woke up to its special potential and responsibility to assist humanities advocacy. The digital humanities are increasingly integrated in the humanities at large. They catch the eye of administrators and funding agencies who otherwise might dismiss the humanities as yesterday's news. They connect across disciplines with science and engineering fields. They have the potential to use new technologies to help the humanities communicate with and adapt to contemporary society. But I have to be honest and tell you that in reality, this is like a mission statement before the business plan has been created. In reality, the past tense in the wake-up call here, the digital humanities community woke up to its special potential and responsibility to assist humanities advocacy, is counterfactual, or at best, proleptic. It's a tactical lie in the service of a hope. In outline form, my thesis for you today about the digital humanities is as follows. While my opening stance is critical, I mean, finally, to be hopeful, to recommend how the deficit in the digital humanities that I am identifying today might convert antithetically into an opportunity. So my thesis has four sequential points. One, the digital humanities have been oblivious to cultural criticism. After the era of May 1968, a date that I use indecisively as a convenience here, one of the leading features of the humanities has been cultural criticism, including both interpretive cultural studies and edgier cultural critique. So I'm being very lax in my definition of cultural criticism here. In parallel, we recall, the computer industry developed the personal computer and networking in the 1970s and 80s in a zeitgeist marked by its own kind of cultural criticism, cyber-libertarianism, or online social activism in the now vintage mode, for example, the computer professionals for social responsibility, which began earlier than the other instance here, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Yet in all that time, as it were, the digital humanities, initially known even more soberly as humanities computing, never once inhaled. Especially by contrast with new media studies, as that field is called, whose provocateur artists, net critics, tactical media theorists, hacktivists, and so on, blend post-60s media theory, post-structuralist theory, and political critique into what Herk Loving calls net critique, which is also the name of his blog, the digital humanities are noticeably missing in action on the cultural critical scene. While digital humanists develop tools, data, and metadata critically, and there are a number of energetic critical debates about those that I might cite if I had more time here, rarely do they extend their critique to the full register of society, economics, politics, or culture, even though every one of those technical debates has those extensions naturally. How the digital humanities advance, channel, or resist today's great post-industrial, neoliberal, corporate, and global flows of information cum capital is thus a question rarely heard in the digital humanities associations, conferences, journals, and projects with which I am familiar. Not even the cliched forms of such issues, for example, the digital divide, surveillance, privacy, copyright, and so on, come in for much playing. It's as if when the order comes down from the funding agencies, the university administrators, and other bodies mediating today's dominant socioeconomic and political beliefs, digital humanists just concentrate on pushing the execute button on projects that amass the most data for the greatest number, process that data most efficiently and flexibly, flexible efficiency being a hallmark of post-industrialism, and manage the whole through ever smarter standards, protocols, schema, templates, and databases, uplifting Frederick Winslow Taylor's original scientific industrialism into ultra-flexible post-industrial content management systems camouflaged as digital editions, libraries, and archives, all without pausing to reflect on the relation of the whole digital juggernaut to the new world order. A digital library is a Trojan horse for neoliberalism, would be the most savage way to put it. Two, The lack of cultural criticism blocks the digital humanities from becoming a full partner of the humanities. Now, of course, cultural criticism is not without its problems, and I've spent much of my career writing about that elsewhere. But for the sake of the digital humanities, I call special attention to the lack of cultural criticism because I fear that it will block the field's further growth just at a critical juncture or threshold point. Consider that digital humanists are finally coming close to their long-deferred dream. This is their romance, really, of being recognized as full partners of the humanities. Extrinsic indicators include stories in the press about the digital humanities being, quote-unquote, the next big thing, the proliferation of digital humanities jobs, programs, panels, and publications, and so on. Perhaps most telling, however, is an intrinsic methodological indicator, the proximity of the digital humanities to the current, it's called the close reading versus the distant reading debate, as it's known in literary studies, with analogies in other humanities and social science fields. In this regard, Kate Hale's essay, How We Read, Close Hyper Machine, is, I think, quite shrewd in positioning this debate in this way. She says that the whole notion of close reading versus distant reading is now supercharged because after May 1968, when literary critics turned their attention to texts outside the normal bounds of literature, to cultural text, then as a kind of response in compensation, close reading, originally practiced and theorized by the new critics, for example, in the U.S., began to be identified in an even more strong and aggressive way with the disciplinary identity of the literary as such, as opposed to the cultural. The debate, in other words, is very near to the disciplinary identity of the field right now. Now, this is not the place for detailed examination of the close versus distant reading debate. I've got a lot more to say about that elsewhere. But it is apropos to recognize that the debate serves as a proxy for the present state of the running battle between new critical method and post-May 1968 cultural criticism. Indeed, we recall that close reading came into dominance only after the new critics fought polemical battles against the prior age of cultural criticism, whose methods were in their own way distant reading. I refer to 19th century historicist, philosophical, religious, moral, and philological reading, which culled vast archives of documents to synthesize a spirit of the times, nations, languages, and peoples, capable of redeeming that other darker people's identity haunting the century, the French revolutionary mob. The new critics displaced such historismus, as the Germans called it, but only to urge an equivalent project of modern reclamation. Rejecting alongside historismus and Geistesgeschichte, also what they call the paraphrase of contemporary scientific discourse and mass media information, the new critics defended their notion of an individual human sensibility rooted in organic culture, originally the yeoman small farm culture idealized in their southern agrarian phase, against that other, they called it northern people's identity of the time, modern mass industrial society. May 1968, of course, marked the return of the repressed, a surge in postmodern rather than modern theories of discourse and or culture that identified the human as ipso facto collective and systemic, part of that northern system. Even if a distinctively new decentralized and bottom-up ideology inspired Deleuze and Guattari, for example, to celebrate wolf packs, Mongol hordes, and schizos, very different from the 19th century notion of the Geist, it seems clear that humanity, from that point on, was congenitally structural, epistemic, class-based, identity group-based, gendered, racial, ethnic, and so on. Currently, distant reading, as Franco Moretti influentially named it, is the catch-all for all that. Indeed, the method is a catch-all for cultural critical methods extending back even earlier than May 1968 to some of the main influences on Moretti's own work, Brodelian historiography and Marxist literary sociology, which he mixes together with new criticism and genre theory, the latter descending, for example, from Western Marxist criticism in the mode of Lukács, to generate what I think is his very powerful thesis of the force of forms, two critical words in his vocabulary in recent years. Now, enter the digital humanities, which have been invited to the main table of debate. It's symbolized by Moretti's collaboration at Stanford with his digital humanist Matthew Jockers. The two have started what they call the Stanford Literary Lab, which you see here. and work together on a research agenda oriented around what they call quantitative stylistics, the digital humanities are now what may be called the practicing partner of distant reading. I choose this phrase not to imply that everyone else since May 1968 has been disengaged from practice, but to spotlight the fact that digital humanities practice assumes a special significance qua practice because it is positioned at a destabilizing location in the post-May 1968 balance of methods. In reality, we recall, the running battle between the new criticism and critical methods after 68 fairly quickly settled into a Cold War. Generation 68, including cultural critics, occupied the high ground of theory. The new criticism, meanwhile, dug into the ordinary, pedagogical, and even existential levels of reading practice to the extent that even high theorists or new historicists took pride in grounding their method in ultra-close reading. An unspoken demilitarized zone thus intervened between close and cultural critical forms of literacy. The digital humanities break this détente. Sophisticated digital humanities methods that require explicit programmatic instructions and metadata schema now take the ground of elemental practice previously occupied by equally sophisticated but tacit close reading methods. Moretti and his collaborators therefore explore, and this is a wonderful phrase of theirs, I think it's first used in this new pamphlet series of theirs, they explore the great unread, as they put it, of vast quantities of literature rather than only exceptional literature through text analysis, data mining, pattern recognition, topic modeling, and visualization methods, the current front line of methodological tools in the digital humanities chest. Practice all at the beginning and not just the interpretive or theoretical end of literary study. Adding to the casus belli is the fact that the contrast between the practices of close reading and the digital humanities is so stark that it is changing the very nature of the ground being fought over, the text. The relevant text is no longer the new critical poem itself or the text itself, but instead the digital humanities archive, corpus, or network, a situation aggravated even further because block quotations serving as a middle ground for fluid movement between close and distant reading are disappearing from view. We imagine, after all, that even as bold a distant reader as Moretti still at times, or even most times, wants to pause to close read on block literary passages as he encounters them. But block quotations have a different status in the digital humanities. Either they drop out of perception entirely because text analysis focuses on micro-level linguistic features, for example, word frequencies. The pronouns in Joseph Slaughter's talk earlier comes to mind here that map directly over macro-level phenomena, for example, different genres or nationalities of the novel, without the need for the middle level of quoted passages, or block quotations exist as what hypertext theorists, originally inspired by Roland Barthes, call lexia, that is, modular chunks in a network where the interest really is in the configuration of the network and not of the individual node or chunk in it. So this is what literature looks like today. If you read Grass, Maps, and Trees by Moretti, you find that your eye hovers over these blocks of visual charts and graphs, which very interestingly occupy roughly the same amount of space on the page as a block quotation and have the same cognitive weight. They are now where the terminus of reading is. Compare this in your mind with the fine readings of block quotations that Joseph Slaughter just instanced for us earlier. I can't imagine a starker contrast than that reading and the amount of cognitive weight that these kinds of charts demand. At the bottom is a little toy that I created. Who knew? That's what Wallace Stevens' poem actually consists of. The upshot is that digital humanists will never get a better invite to the table, as I put it, where the mainstream humanities are renegotiating the relation between qualitative methods premised on a high quotient of tacit understanding and quantitative methods requiring a different rigor of programmatic understanding. But will digital humanists be able to claim their place at the table? Or, as in the past, will they once more be merely servants at the table whose practice is perceived to be purely instrumental to the main work of the humanities? This is the blockage in the growth of the field that I fear. Consider the nature of some of the scholarly works that have recently had the greatest impact in turning the attention of the humanities at large to large literary systems. And here you see some resonance with earlier talk, Johnny's talk earlier. For example, Moretti's Grass Maps Trees, and a work that I've been absorbed by recently, Pascal Casanova's The World Republic of Letters. Both these remarkable books, which participate in what Jim English has recently called the new sociology of literature, frame their corpora or system scale analyses of literature in cultural criticism, specifically a combination of Bernoullian historiography, Marxist sociology in Casanova's case, and Emmanuel Wallerstein-like center versus periphery analysis, and global scale literary comparatism. Had I known about the earlier talk today, I would have certainly included that here. The lesson to digital humanists should be clear. While digital humanists have the practical tools and data, they will never be in the same league as Moretti, Casanova, and others unless they too can move seamlessly between text analysis and cultural analysis. After all, it can be said that digital materials on the scale of corpora, databases, distributed repositories, and so on, the specialties of the digital humanities, are ipso facto cultural phenomena. The people behind Google's Ngrams viewer say that. In their groundbreaking science article, paralleled by Google's release of their Ngram viewer, Jean-Baptiste Michel and Erez Lieberman, with their collaborators at Harvard, call their quantitative analyses of Google Books a contribution to, and this is a made-up word of theirs, culturomics. So too, the Software Studies Initiative at the University of California, San Diego, is well advanced in developing what it calls cultural analytics. Here's how you read 1 million manga pages, for example, and this is how Lev Manovich reads a novel. Where are the digital humanists in this picture? Three, the digital humanities can transcend their servant role in the humanities through leadership in advocating for the humanities. Engagement with cultural criticism, I'm saying, is necessary for the digital humanities to be a full partner of the mainstream humanities today, but it's not enough for digital humanists to add cultural criticism to their brief in a Me Too kind of way. After all, they're very late in the game. Partners are not just followers. They become partners only by being able to rotate into the leadership role when their special competencies are needed. Truly to partner with the mainstream humanities, digital humanists now need to incorporate cultural criticism in a way that shows leadership in the humanities and, for that matter, in cultural criticism. I believe that the service function of the digital humanities, as literal as running the actual servers if need be, can convert into leadership if such service can be extended beyond facilitating research and teaching in the academy, the usual digital humanities remit, to assisting in advocacy outside the academy in the humanities' present hour of social, economic, political, and I'm going to add this, communicational need. I refer first, of course, to the economic recession beginning in 2007 that gave warrant to nations, local governments, and universities to cut funding for some humanities programs and arts in favor of fields perceived to apply more directly to society's well-being, especially the STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, although one would want today to, as if updating the Dow, probably replace mathematics with another M, medicine. But secondly, I also refer to a conversion peril for the humanities, the continuing decline in their ability to communicate with the public. What is new and interesting about this decline today is that the internet and most recently Web 2.0 have altered the very idea of effective public communication by changing the relation between experts, traditionally those with something valuable to communicate, and the public, who traditionally listened to expertise or at least media reports about expertise and responded with votes, tuition dollars, fees, and so on to support the various expert institutions and professions. As perhaps best exemplified by Wikipedia, the new network public is now developing its own faculty of expertise through bottom-up processes of credentialing, for example, Wikipedia's administrators, refereeing, governance, and so on. It's going to take at least a generation for the academy to create or adapt the institutional protocols, practices, and technologies that can negotiate a new compact of knowledge between expertise and networked public knowledge. To give you a single instance, between the standards of peer review and crowdsourcing. In the meantime, the humanities are caught in a particularly vicious form of the communicational impasse of expertise. While the network public still tolerates specialized knowledge from scientists, engineers, doctors, and others, it seems to have ever less patience for specialized humanities knowledge, since in the domain of human experience, every man with his blog is an autodidact. In short, just when the humanities need more than ever to communicate their vision of humanity and also their own value to the public, they find themselves increasingly cut off from the modes of communication that produce some of today's most robust discourses of public knowledge. Hence, the unique leadership opportunity for the digital humanities, which are ideally positioned to create, adapt, and disseminate new methods for communicating between the humanities and the public. At a minimum, digital humanists, perhaps in alliance with social scientists who study internet social activism, might facilitate innovative uses of new media for such traditional forms of advocacy as essays, editorials, petitions, letter-writing campaigns, and so on. But really, digital humanists should create technologies that fundamentally reimagine humanity's advocacy. The goal, I suggest, is to build advocacy into the ordinary work of the humanities so that research and teaching organically generate advocacy in the form of publicly meaningful representations of the humanities. As a starting point, for example, consider how something like the Open Journal System's publication platform might be extended for such a purpose. Created by the Public Knowledge Project, OJS facilitates the publication and management of online journals. You see an example here, while also providing what they call reading tools that through algorithmic means aggregate for users additional materials that they might use to place that research in context. Imagine now that OJS could be mashed up with text analysis and extraction tools, as well as output platforms like Omeka, or the Simile exhibit and timeline widgets, designed to break scholarship free of the document format, with the result that the publication process automatically generates from every article a capture of humanities scholarship that's not just an abstract, but something more akin to a brochure, poster, video, or other high-impact brief. That is something that could expose the gist of scholarship for public view and use. Now, this is just a very elementary example. This is the tip of an iceberg. What I'm really outlining here, and I'm aware that the melon is in the audience, yeah, this is an infrastructural building project and a very challenging one. Can we adapt or create the technological infrastructure to build a public relations dimension into humanities research and teaching in an organic way? So it's not add-on labor, but part of the function of what we do. The idea is to create ways to allow humanities scholars deliberately, spontaneously, or collaboratively to generate public awareness about their research and teaching that propagates outward as part of the natural process of research and teaching. After all, millions in the US, I don't know whether this will translate across the ocean or not, tune in each week to watch crab fishermen in the Discovery Channel's show, The Deadliest Catch, one of the most compelling and urgent proletarian epics of our age. Humanists may not be salt of the earth crabbers, but surely they ought on occasion to try to share the excitement of the chase by which breakthrough intellectual discoveries and movements come about. A beautifully designed report published by the Joint Information Systems Committee, JISC, in 2010, entitled Inspiring Research, Inspiring Scholarship, gives a flavor of what I mean. The text of the brochure begins in an everyman as researcher mode. Imagine walking into one of Britain's great cathedrals. As you take in the architectural, cultural, and religious ambiance, your personal mobile device automatically engages with the content on your behalf, and so on. Now, parenthetically, of course, we're locked there into a cultural heritage paradigm of the humanities. In a fuller discussion, we'd have to discuss what vision of the humanities we actually want to communicate. Similarly, one of my initiatives, while participating last year in a working group of the University of California's Commission on the Future, which was convened by the regents of our system to explore new options in a bleak future of permanently reduced state funding, was to canvas humanities, arts, and social science scholars throughout the UC for showcase research examples that might be presented in an advocacy effort. The results, which I mocked up as a document full of blurbs and pictures, are not ready for publication. They've not been fact-checked. I don't have the permissions yet. But I can attest that the examples are definitively there. Sample headlines include Treasure, a previously unknown letters by Benjamin Franklin, World History for Us All, which is a K through 12, elementary level curriculum initiative. Students learn from California Holocaust survivors, the prehistory of multitasking you see in human rights around the world, what is the community reading, and so on and so forth. While humanities scholarship can sometimes seem abstruse, minute, or nonsensical to the public, which, however, of course, is true of all fields, there are also a stunning number of projects that intuitively, profoundly, and movingly demonstrate the public value of the humanities, many of them not incidentally designed around or otherwise centrally facilitated by the digital humanities. And I've got to tell you that about 4:30 one morning, as I was working under deadline pressure to produce this document for the recommendation that was going in to the Commission of the Future, I kind of stepped back and looked at this messy pile of data, to go back to the messy word that I was looking at, and it nearly brought tears to my eyes. I was a romanticist originally, after all. We are not just Google with its minimalist zero-degree notion of humanitarianism, do no evil. We actually do good, and if you just add it up, the number of projects that we do that could be communicated to the public intuitively as doing good. There's quite a lot of weight behind that, and that's what we need to capture and expose to view. So finally, four, beyond acting in an instrumental role, and you'll see how this connects fully with yesterday's conference discourse, the digital humanities can most profoundly advocate for the humanities by helping to broaden the very idea of instrumentalism, technological and otherwise. This could be its unique contribution to cultural criticism. Earlier, you'll note that I deprecated the idea of service. The digital humanities, I said, need to transcend their role as just a servant of the humanities to take a leadership role. Yet, in apparent contradiction, my imagination of such leadership has so far been instrumental in a manner that does not exceed a narrow, even if it is cutting edge, I think, service concept. The digital humanities, I argue, can create, adapt, and disseminate new tools and methods for reestablishing communication between the humanities and the public. This contradiction brings to view a complex matrix of issues that is both a problem and an opportunity for the digital humanities, since ultimately it shows digital humanists to occupy a strategic niche in the humanities and even of society as a whole, where those same issues are in play. Within the digital humanities, to start with, we observe that service and instrumentalism are part of a tangle of related concepts, including functionalism, tool-based, and, as I earlier deployed the term, practice, about which the field is deeply insecure. On the one hand, digital humanists worry that their field is too instrumental. Witness the vigorous thread on the humanist listserv in 2010 on the topic, and this is a quotation, industrialization of the digital humanities. William McCarthy, the list moderator at King's here, touched off the discussion by reflecting, quote, "I fear that the digital humanities is becoming dominated by purely technical concerns of implementation," close quote. Just as rambunctious was the humanist thread that McCarthy triggered the next year with this post entitled In Denial, where, to use internet parlance, he trolled, that is, baited the list with a statement, quote, "I'd be interested to know if you've recently heard anyone assert that the computer is just a tool, and what you think that they might have meant by that phrase." The sustained discussion that followed really shows that he hit a sore spot. Yet on the other hand, digital humanists also worry that their field is not instrumental enough by comparison with engineering fields, where instrumentality has the prestige of innovation and of building things. Thus, the "I am more builder than thou" controversy that arose around Stephen Ramsey's paper at the latest Modern Language Association convention, which threw down the gauntlet to those in the digital humanities who mainly just study, interpret, or supervise by saying, and I'm quoting Ramsey here, "Do you have to know how to code?" I say yes. Personally, I think digital humanities is about building things. If you're not making anything, you are not a digital humanist, close quote. But now, I want to widen the context. The insecurity of the digital humanities about instrumentalism, we should realize, simply shifts to a new register, a worry experienced by the humanities at large. On the one hand, The humanities also struggle against the perception that they are primarily instrumental because their assigned role is to provide students with a skill set, that's a word that's come up today at least once, needed for future life and work. The rhetoric of university course catalogs, which speak of the humanities as providers of critical analysis, language skills, and so on, thus combines with the insidious logic of higher teaching loads in the humanities to imply that the main function of the humanities is to teach students the analytical, communicational, and other abilities needed as preparatory means toward other ends. On the other hand, clearly the humanities suffer even more from seeming to be non-instrumental to the point of uselessness. In hard times such as the present, a real-life incident from my own experience as chair of my department, parents actually come up to chairs of English departments at graduation to complain that their daughter's humanities degree is only good for working at Starbucks. I propose to you that that is the acid test for justification of the humanities. Don't bother trying to write essays justifying to us and to administrators the value of the humanities. Imagine yourself confronting that parent. How would you answer? The catch-22 is at the heart of the humanities work to become research enterprises, equipping students with specialized competencies and vocabularies, the more cut off they seem from practical use. This is particularly galling for post-May 1968 cultural critics who address their advanced research methods to praxis, but if anything, reinforce the impression that humanist critique is only interpretive, reflective, politically marginal, skeptical, nihilist, you know, the list goes on. Now let me widen the context to the furthest extent, and then I will have done. To be fair to the humanities, they are just a canary in the mine for the problem that modern Western society has with instrumentalism. Generally, accusations of media determinism and technological determinism leveled at media theorists, for instance, are merely symptomatic of the uncertainty that modernity feels about secular determinism in total. Touch just one of the levers of media or technological determinism, and it soon becomes clear that they connect to the total machine of historical, material, and social determinism that is both the condition and the dilemma of modernity. I have much more to say about that in the fuller version of this piece, but I'll cut to my conclusion, which is that perhaps, and this is just a hopeful guess, there is an appropriate, unique contribution that the digital humanities can make to cultural criticism at present, and that is to use the digital tools, paradigms, and concepts that they work with to help widen the idea of instrumentality. The goal is to practice and think critically about digital technologies. Obvious examples include such topics as metadata standards or network protocols in a way that scales into engaging critically with power, finance, and other governance protocols of the world. Ultimately, the goal is to widen the mandate of instrumentality so that both humanistic and STEM fields are included in a culturally broad and not just narrowly purposive ideal of service. Really, my conclusion here is that we don't need to think ourselves outside the box of instrumentalism. We just need to substitute for that word of the instrumental a very much older word associated with the humanities, and that is the word service. After all, there's not a single grand challenge announced by the Obama administration. The grand challenges in Global Health Initiative, which the Gates Foundation has sponsored, the U.S. National Academy of Engineering, and other agencies or foundations in the areas of energy, environment, biomedicine, food, water, education, and so on, that does not, as an equal partner, require humanistic involvement. All these issues have a necessary cultural dimension, whether it's cause, effect, or both, and all, therefore, need the public service of humanist and increasingly digital humanist participants. And I'll close with just one more funding item. If earlier I called for a grand challenge project of my own, building the technological infrastructure that would build public relations into contemporary humanities work, the matching grand challenge is to build the intellectual infrastructure that would allow digital humanists to do that intelligently. And that requires a couple of intermediary steps. Someone needs to step up and fund and prod and push the digital humanities community to talk in a single, for example, gigantic conference with the new media theory crowd. There's very little connection between those two crowds right now. And secondly, to fund such a forum that gathers together the digital humanists and the science technology studies crowd. There are very thin pipes between those communities right now as well. That would be a step, an intermediary step toward building the intellectual infrastructure that would accompany and help guide the technological infrastructure I'm hoping that digital humanists can build to help all of us who are humanists reach out and talk to the public in a new way. I'll close there.